there are no TNCs in town or in Alaska unless that is addressed.
A proposal change to Anchorage and state rules could help Uber come back to Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 3rd. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, a Juneau forum about the state's fiscal problems brings together beer, ice cream, and frank conversation.
Alaska's indeed kimchi, and all the bland food options have left town.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The state's Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development is trying to clarify the status of on-site cannabis consumption in Alaska. A vote yesterday by the Marijuana Control Board in Juneau shot down a proposal that would have allowed for Dutch-style marijuana cafes. But in a press release today, the department clarified this isn't a permanent ban on using marijuana inside permitted retail locations. The department is encouraging retail shops that are interested in allowing customers to use on-site to continue filing the relevant paperwork. There are no details yet on an alternative proposal regulating on-site consumption set to go before the control board, or a timeline for when regulations might be finished. A new measure going before the Anchorage Assembly could clear the way for app-based ride services in the coming year. Anchorage Assembly member Bill Evans wrote the ordinance, which seeks to regulate what are called transportation network companies, or TNCs. Those include the likes of Uber and Lyft, among others. Evans says the city transportation code was written before smartphones and startup companies began disrupting the taxi industry in cities across the world. The ordinance requires TNC drivers to have insurance, makes the companies conduct background checks on all drivers, and includes a once yearly fee for operating in Anchorage.
So if Uber comes to town, that's what Uber has to pay, $15,000 to operate all their vehicles.
Uber operated in Anchorage from September 2014 until March 2015, when an Anchorage judge ordered the company to either continue offering its rides for free, comply with all taxi rules, or cease operations. A separate fight broke out in the state capitol after the state division of insurance ruled Uber and other TNCs could not operate in Alaska until they had secured workers' compensation insurance. The ruling was based on a view of drivers as employees, not contractors, as Uber claims they are. That interpretation could become a moot point. A bill in the state Senate from Anchorage Republican Mia Costello could change that provision in state law. Evans says if the Senate bill passes, it'll pave the way for the local measure.
From what I understand, there are no TNCs in town or in Alaska unless that is addressed. So that's the fundamental change. That's the fix that had to be done.
The local taxi industry has heavily opposed both allowing TNCs in Anchorage and creating more taxi permits. During public testimony, dozens of drivers told the assembly they're barely able to make a living in the current situation. They say it will only worsen with more taxis on the road. The Bureau of Land Management is taking public feedback on a new management plan for over 13 million acres of federal lands west of Fairbanks and the Dalton Highway. Central Yukon Resource Management Plan project manager Michelle Ethan says the Dalton Highway area alone encompasses diverse resources and uses.
There's a lot of mining that occurs in that area. There's a lot of recreational access that occurs in that area. And it's a utility corridor.
Ethan says the western portion of the planning area covers federal property in the Koyokuk River region, as well as around numerous villages, which have their own priorities. The central Yukon area is the latest of several addressed by BLM and updated management plans. The agency hopes to have a signed record of decision on the central Yukon area plan by early 2020. The Alaska legislature has a lot on its plate trying to fix the state's multi-billion dollar budget deficit, and a couple of budget experts are adding to the menu. They're inviting the public to weigh in over ice cream and beer. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins and Rasha McChesney check to see if these treats might make the budget more appetizing.
More than 20 people are crowded into Copa, a local ice cream shop in Juneau, to hear about what's happening with Alaska's budget. People dig small plastic spoons into flavors like Fiscal Crunch and Sustainable Blueberry Budget. Carol Treem is here with a friend. And while the ice cream doesn't make the fiscal situation taste any sweeter, she says her main reason for coming is to learn.
I feel like I should know more about the budget than I do, especially as a state employee, because it, affects my livelihood.
Jobs like Treem's could be on the chopping block as the Alaska legislature looks at ways to reduce state spending. There's a more than $3 billion hole to fill this year. And with declining oil production and weak revenue, Cliff Groh says we can't keep living like we have. Groh is the chair of Alaska Common Ground, a public policy nonprofit, and he's a former commissioner at the Department of Revenue. He's here presenting with Gunnar Knapp, an economist. And you could say Groh's role is to simplify the jargon of the budget crisis. That's his mission.
Alaska's in deep kimchi. And all the bland food options have left town.
Did you just say kimchi?
I did. The choices are spicy and not the easy meatloaf and mashed potatoes. People need to think clearly about the difficult choices we face.
Personally, I like kimchi. But Groh says that means the options to fix Alaska's budget are not that appealing. Deep cuts to state infrastructure, creating a state income or sales tax, repealing the oil and gas tax credit program. We can't just pick one.
But those are the kinds of choices Alaska faces now because the savings are running out very fast.
Are we going to have to eat our kimchi eventually?
That's probably one good way to think about it, that or another equally spicy dish.
Groh and Knapp give the same spiel to the audience for over an hour. And after everyone leaves, they make their way over to McGivney's, where they'll do it again. They're joined by reporter Rasha McChesney.
In a back room at the downtown sports bar, Knapp and Groh pick up their informal budget conversation with an after-hours crowd. And they aren't shy about telling other people to get comfortable.
By the way, those of you who just came in, there's beer. Get some beer.
Yeah, that's right.
Enjoy the beer.
Knapp kicks off his shoes and reclines on a bar stool while giving the crowd a broad overview of the budget. The state's dependence on oil money has left lawmakers reeling, trying to figure out where to cut and how deep. So far, Knapp says they've been relying on savings. The crowd is a mix of lawmakers, legislative aides, community members, and even a former deputy commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And while the conversation is relaxed, they're grappling with some difficult concepts.
Is your question, is there hope, or are we all screwed? Is that the question?
Yeah, fundamentally, that's the question. I mean, I could double down or I could leave.
No.
You
know?
It's those same concepts that lawmakers struggle with by day at the state capitol just a few blocks away. Groh says the competing philosophies of cutting further, capping spending, taxing Alaskans, and dipping into the permanent fund make it difficult for the legislators to work together.
And Alaska's political situation surrounding the fiscal problems are sort of like what you might see in an old spaghetti western or a Quentin Tarantino film.
A standoff. He says Alaskans have been very good at announcing what they don't want. Now, they need to think about what they will accept. And sometimes, a scoop of ice cream or a swig of beer can help that reality go down easier. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney.
And I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Marines, National Guard members, and reservists who were stationed even temporarily at North Carolina's Camp Lejeune from the 1950s through the late 80s may have diseases related to contaminated drinking water on the base. Verdi Bowen is the director of the Alaska Office of Veterans Affairs. He says some of the contamination came from gasoline and diesel fuel that leaked into the drinking water supply.
But it also had cleaning contaminants from a dry cleaner from off the installation. It had it was leaking back into the installation water source.
Bowen says 1,400 cases nationwide have been filed so far. He doesn't know how many of those could be in Alaska because he says the state office files thousands of claims each year, but doesn't break them down into categories.
there's these items that we have currently identified, which is adult leukemia, aplastic anemia, bladder cancer, kidney cancer, liver cancer, multiple myeloma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and Parkinson's disease. Those items are what they identified today. But if you file today and you have something else, that could go on the list tomorrow, just like our Agent Orange registry has done.
Bowen says there's no deadline for filing for disability compensation, but he encourages veterans and active duty members to get registered and screened for exposure to toxins. More information is at our website, alaskapublic.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new bill in Juneau could legalize taking selfies in the voting booth.
The first time I was on the ballot, I took a photo. It was a meaningful memento.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
On Monday, the 19th Alaska Forum on the Environment kicks off in Anchorage. The annual gathering draws hundreds of people from across the state and beyond to spend 5 days discussing a wide range of environmental concerns. Kurt Ilo is a former EPA enforcement officer, and he's been the executive director of the Alaska Forum since its inception. He spoke with APRN's Lori Townsend.
The Obama administration clearly recognized that the climate is changing, there's a lot of human impact. We may not see the same tone or direction in research. It remains to be seen yet how things will be addressed under the Trump administration. Is it too early to know, or are you hearing anxiety from scientists and what they may have concerns about going forward?
Our participants in the event, the 1,200 folks that come, are all feeling a bit of apprehension and uncertainty. And how much of that is founded on information and facts or exaggerated facts or misinformation is concerning to me as well. I would bet the folks coming in are generally apprehensive of, you know, how is their tribal status going to remain? Are we going to have funds for the tribes to continue doing solid waste work and all the other great things tribes are doing? But we're also the nonprofit organizations. How are they going to adapt? And what do they need to adapt to? I don't think there's any answers. And I think that's the pulse, is really just the uncertainty. And there really isn't a particular thing to act on yet.
It's the 19th year, almost two decades of the forum. How has the involvement of tribes and tribal organizations changed in that nearly two decades from the beginning until what you'll see this year?
At least from my perspective, there's a couple things. The tribes that come, they represent, or more so even the people from rural Alaska, represents more than 60% of our audience that comes to the forum every year. They are the most active participants. They come early. They stay late. They make every session. They're very dedicated as a general rule. What I've seen in, I think, 20 years is the level of education is quite different. And in the first few years, we dealt with a lot of anger. Our keynote speakers were often faced with very angry participants. I think their frustrations were being vetted that way. And now, 19 years, 20 years later, we're looking at questions that are very highly technical afterwards, where the tone has changed and much more sophisticated questions are coming from the audience and the participants. And our villages and tribes have just come a long way in 20 years.
Kurt, who's coming from outside to be involved this year?
The most exciting outside speaker is actually two folks coming. One of our keynotes, Dr. Klassen, is coming from South Africa, and Karen Norte is coming from South Africa as well. She'll be doing a breakout session where Dr. Klassen will be doing a keynote on Thursday morning. And they're going to hope to draw some parallels between the transboundary issues they deal with in Africa and the ones we deal with between us and Canada and other nations. And so that's kind of exciting. We're going to get a complete new perspective and maybe perhaps see how somewhere else on the other side of the world is dealing with similar problems.
Kurt Ilo is the executive director of the Alaska Forum on the Environment. Links to the agenda and registration information are at our website, alaskapublic.org. In Alaska, it's illegal to exhibit a picture of a marked ballot. Sharing a ballot selfie isn't a criminal offense, like in some states, but it is technically grounds for invalidating that vote. However, one academic warns that relaxing these laws could enable vote buying and coercion. KTOO's Caroline Halter reports.
On October 27, 2016, former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin expressed her support for presidential candidate Donald Trump by posting a picture of her ballot on Facebook. The picture got 17,000 reactions, 560 shares, and 616 comments. It also generated news articles questioning whether Palin had violated state law. Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins thinks it's time for the so-called ballot selfie to be recognized as a form of political speech in Alaska.
Ballots are, and voting are in a certain sense, an expression of what your view of society should be in terms of who you believe in electing in order to sort of affect that vision of society. And I think that's an incredibly important form of speech and should be free and should be protected.
The 27-year-old state representative is sponsoring House Bill 7, which would make it legal to share ballot selfies, as well as pictures of marked ballots like Palin's. Josie Banky directs the State Division of Elections. She says Alaska's current law is both unclear and impossible to enforce, and she supports the ballot selfie bill.
For the division, we support clarifying language. This is just going to give us clarification, you know, to give direction on ballot selfies. And, of course, we support any legislation that promotes the act of voting.
In states where they do enforce bans on ballot selfies, such as New Hampshire and Colorado, federal courts ruled that ballot selfies are protected under the First Amendment. Rick Hassan is a professor at the University of California, Irvine, where he specializes in election law. He opposes the legalization of ballot selfies and says concerns about vote buying and coercion are still relevant.
We're not worried so much about people taking pictures and posting it on social media and then selling their vote, but people taking those pictures and just sharing them privately with whoever might be coercing them or paying them. A law doesn't have to be perfect in order for it to be constitutional, and so it could be a useful way, even if not a perfect way, to deter such conduct.
Representative Christ Tompkins has acknowledged concerns about vote buying, but noted that this type of voter fraud is rare. He thinks his bill will be well received.
I may be more familiar and exposed to the way people express themselves online than perhaps some of my colleagues. But I've remained pretty confident that all of my colleagues will find the current law pretty dumb and want to change it because it is. So I suspect that this will have multi-generational appeal.
For him, the legislation is simply a matter of keeping with the times.
I think on election day, or even prior to election day with absentee ballots, I would say my Facebook feed is pleasantly populated with ballot selfies. And the first time I was on the ballot, I took a photo. It was a meaningful memento to me. So here I am, a criminal. I'm trying to emancipate myself.
Christ Tompkins is also working with state election officials on an amendment that would address concerns about electioneering. In Juneau, I'm Caroline Halter.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
If you're a rural Alaska resident with an interest in preserving subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing for future generations, consider applying for a seat on a Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. Deadline is Friday, February 3rd, 2017. More at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Wesley Earle. This week on AK, orphan otter pups.
In coastal Alaska, a bacterial infection has caused adult sea otter die-offs in record numbers, and that's a problem for otter pups. Researchers have seen a steep increase in the number of orphaned pups in the last several years. Now, the places where rescued pups would normally live out their lives are nearly full, putting volunteers in a tough spot. KBBI's Shayla Farzan reports from Homer.
Until recently, when an orphaned sea otter was found on a beach, volunteers helped get it out of harm's way and into rehabilitation. The Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward was the only place that would accept them. Once there, people like Brett Long would get to work.
This is a feed me please.
Long is the animal husbandry director at the center. He's in charge of caring for the baby otters. While that might sound like a dream job, don't be fooled. It's hard work.
It's the screaming child, right? Hey, it's your turn to take care of it.
All four of the otter pups at the Sea Life Center are orphans. Over the last several years, Streptococcus bacteria has been killing Alaska's sea otters. Since 2002, an estimated 328 otters have died statewide from the infection. And that means more orphan pups to care for. Long coordinates a team that cares for the otters round the clock. Because of their fast metabolism, sea otters eat about 25% of their body weight in seafood every day. At the Sea Life Center, all of that food lives in a freezer, about the size of a studio apartment.
We've got smelt, squid, two or three different types of herring, pollock, capelin, mussels.
And it's not just feeding that's time-consuming. Because many of the pups are too young to know how to groom themselves, the staff has to do it for them. They use blow dryers, towels, and combs to clean the fur and fluff it up. For Long, the demanding nature of the work feels familiar.
I have two nephews that were born 3 months early, and so the first 3 months of their life was in a neonatal care ICU, and that's what raising sea otters is like. It's a little beauty salon mixed with a neonatal ICU.
As the pups grow older, trainers work with them individually to help prepare them for lives in education centers.
Good up. Good.
In an outdoor enclosure, trainer Juliana Kim trains Tongat how to roll on his back and accept a fish. The pup arrived at the Sea Life Center last spring after turning up in a Cordova parking lot.
Tongat, good boy.
The Sea Life Center isn't equipped to keep the pups forever. Eventually, they'll be moved to educational facilities or aquaria, either in the U.S. or abroad. But the options for orphan otters are becoming fewer and fewer. Only a limited number of facilities meet the strict requirements set by the U.S. Animal Welfare Act, which allow them to accept otters. Right now, there are only 14 facilities licensed in North America. Debbie Tobin is a biology professor at Kenai Peninsula College in Homer and a member of the Marine Mammal Stranding Network.
You have to have the right sort of aquarium or facility or a zoo to house a sea otter. It's an expensive and difficult task to take on a sea otter if you don't already have all of the setup for that. So many of the facilities in the U.S. are essentially full.
That means rehab facilities are now turning pups away. While the four pups we heard earlier have since moved to new homes, the Sea Life Center has no plans to accept more. Now, when volunteers like Tobin find orphan pups, they have to leave them be.
We've had to physically put them back laying on the beach, knowing that very likely you come by the next day and they're either there dead or they've been scavenged, or if you're lucky, they washed out to sea and you don't know what happened to them. But oftentimes we go back out the next day and they're dead lying on the beach.
For Tobin, leaving pups on the beach is a bitter pill to swallow.
It's really, really hard to put that actual pup back down on the beach. I'm going to cry and walk away.
Several organizations are in the process of applying to become certified to house otters. But if the current pace of adult otter die-offs continues, it's unlikely there will ever be enough facilities to keep up with the demand. In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzan.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Lawrence Bohovic in Wrangell. Bohovic has lived all over Southeast Alaska since he was a baby and recently celebrated his 100th birthday, January 4th.
My father was a fisher and fishing and trapper. He came up in 1912 to see what the country was like. Most of it was around Wrangell, up towards June a little ways. That's where he met my mother when he was fishing up around a little village. My father first went to the chief and asked him if he could marry my mother, and he had to get consent from the chief. So he did, and then he brought her to down to Wrangell, I think. Yeah, when I was in Sheldon Jackson, you weren't allowed to speak any native languages. You were punished. But now they're having schools for native languages. Yeah, I think it's wonderful now these kids can learn a language like that. It's too bad that our mother didn't teach us that language. They all spoke it, you know. We used to listen to them tell stories. They'd tell stories and every once in a while bust out laughing, probably talking about men. This old friend of ours that I used to do a little work for, cutting wood, he left money with the stipulation that I go to school. He didn't give me the money. So I had to go to school, University of Washington. I didn't know anything about a city either when I got down there. Well, you're amazed, you know. It's unbelievable to see so many people and such a large place. It takes you a little while to get used to it. After college, I came here and I had to start making a living. So that was the first thing I thought of. Three of us built a little boat, a little sand boat. And we did pretty good with that little boat.
Lawrence Bohovic lives in Wrangell. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Shayla Farzan and Aaron Bolton. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Wesley Early.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Lori Townsend in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Elizabeth Jenkins, Caroline Halter, and Rasha McChesney in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. Lori Townsend is our news director. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. If subsistence is important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. Deadline to apply is Friday, February 3rd. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.